The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am ecstatic to have tonight's author here. The Guardian describes Paul Lynch's Prophet Song, winner of the 2023 Booker Prize, as a brilliant, haunting, and crucial book for our current times. It tells the gorgeous yet dystopian but plausible tale of a family caught in the clutches of an increasingly authoritarian Ireland. Lynch's earlier novels include Red Sky and Morning, named a Best Book of the Year by the Irish Times, the Toronto Star, and the Irish Independent, The Black Snow, winner of France's Prix Libre Annou for Best Foreign Novel, Grace, winner of the 2018 Curry Group Irish Novel of the Year, and Beyond the Sea, published to international acclaim and winner of France's 2022 Prix Jean de Mer. Lynch previously served as chief film critic for Ireland's Sunday Tribune newspaper and regularly contributed film articles to the Sunday Times. He will be joined in conversation this evening by Wesley Stace, novelist, musician, Shandyite, and the impresario of the Cabinet of Wonders. Please welcome our guests to the Free Library.
Should we drop it casually into the middle of the...
Yeah, wait till I start to...
Good evening.
How is everybody?
We're discussing whether I'll do a reading or not. Will I do a reading?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll do the reading when I'm starting to get tired, because I have to warn you, I was in India and then Dubai, which is -5 Irish time, and then I've just come here, which is +5. So the last 2 days were, you know, the Dali clock when it's all... melted, right? That's my body clock. I'm a melted timepiece, but it's going to be fine.
Don't worry. You're totally safe in my hands. So tell us, congratulations on your excellent book, Prophet Song. Thank you. Take us back to that, very handily, the little press piece that they sent out in America comes with a very informative and helpful essay that you wrote called Writing a Modern Novel, How to Compete with the Tyranny of the New.
All right, okay. And I don't even remember what I wrote for that one, but
we'll
see what happens.
Well, let's see how consistent you are, because I just read it.
Okay.
But because everybody here hasn't had the chance to read that, take us back a little to your inspiration for the book originally, when you were, when you had to write another novel.
So, I was writing the wrong novel for a while, and writing the wrong novel is perfectly good. It's a perfectly good thing to do. Nothing's ever wasted. But I knew I was writing the wrong novel. I was sort of just trying to find a story that could also carry my obsessions, and was failing at this, and was just drilling through just hard granite day after day, and I knew it was the wrong novel. And but I'm so just ridiculous that I persisted for 6 whole months, and then it was about 3 o'clock on a Friday. It was in December 2018, and the very start of December, and I just thought, God, this piece of... I'm done, I'm stopping, and I'll come back in Monday morning, and I will open a new document and just see what happens. I had a feeling there was something there. And this is very important when you're an artist. You live in tune with your subconscious, or at least you're receptive to that door into the dark, and you have a sense sometimes maybe there's something there that I can pull out. There's something waiting. And I didn't know what it was, but I just had this sense. So Monday morning came. I didn't even think about it over the weekend. I sat down, created the blank page, and looked at it and closed my eyes. And then I wrote the first page of Prophet Song. And I wrote it as you know, as I'll read it later, but that's how I wrote it, pretty much. And what's really interesting about that for me as a writer is I did not know what I was doing. And yet in the first few sentences is encoded symbolically the meaning of the novel that I was going to write. So this is the thing that fascinates me, is that rationally, as a human being, I think I'm in charge, but really I know very little, that there's so much that goes on underneath the trapdoor of consciousness, that there's another aspect of self when you're an artist or writer, that it knows more than you do. It seems to have a plan. It just doesn't tell you it has the plan. You just have to sort of make yourself available to it. But you asked me what was going through my mind as well, I think, and there was so much happening in 2018 or in the preceding years that was sort of leaking into the pages of the novel, which was the political situation in the world, the sense of chaos that we all find ourselves in now, even it's deepened further, it seems, and that doesn't surprise me. It's why I wrote the damn book. And but there had been Brexit, which just seemed incredible. It just seemed inconceivable. There had been Trump, and there had been this lurch to the right across Europe. And I'm not somebody who's you know, I'm not a political fiction writer. It's something that I'm decidedly not. But this stuff was leaking into the text, leaking into my mind, and I had this moment that was so, it was a moment of key awareness, and I realized it much later when I was looking back after I'd written Prophet Song. I'd written an essay in 2018 for something else that you won't even find online now, because the website it's completely disappeared, so I might as well have never written it. But it was useful for me to look back, and I was able to see that in early 2018, I reread Hermann Hesse's Steppenwolf. And it's a book I read in my early 20s. And poor Hermann Hesse, he gets such a hard time now. The critics just hate him. They think he's juvenile. And I think they're completely wrong.
I just read Gertrude again. It's one of my favorite books.
Yeah. I mean, he's... There's something about Hesse that's really worth digging back into again. You know, at least he speaks to me as an artist. Like I really tap into his what it is he's going after, and it's got very little to do with, you know, pulling teenagers up by the, you know, raising the consciousness of teenagers. But that's one thing that he does. But anyhow, I reread that book, and I had previously read it in my early twenties, and I remembered. There was a page in that book, a passage, where Harry Haller, who's the sort of the book's anti-hero or central figure anyhow, and he was looking out at Germany in 1927, and he was looking at the complete fragmentation of the politics, at the anti-Semitism, the xenophobia, the unraveling. And he said that the next war is inevitable. And I remember when I read that, I thought, wow, what must it have been like to be alive during such a time? Because in the 1990s, it was so damn sedate. You know, it was like Fukuyama said that history had come to an end, and it felt like that. It was we were done. We were finished. We put our feet up and in the West, and it was the utopia. And when I reread it in 2018, that passage, I went, oh, my God. This is the now. This is now. And that's the beauty of rereading classics, that you're always coming back to a book as a different self, but also that book can also measure It can also measure you, it measures the times you're in. It can show you what's changed, because what had changed I hadn't really noticed, because the temperature just goes up so slowly.
Was that, just to take you back a bit, was that book you rejected, was that the book, what did that have any bearing on Prophet Song?
Yeah.
And in what way?
It's a good question. It had ideas, similar themes, similar obsessions, but it was so wrong. It was so hopelessly wrong that, you know, at some point I may be asked to sell my writing archive to university, and they're not going to get it. I mean, literally, it's just going to disappear. It's so not Paul Lynch, because all my books have a consistency. You read it, you're like, this is a Lynch novel, and was not a Lynch novel. I don't know what was going on. And sometimes you just have to exercise these things out of you so they're gone. And but the thing is what I've learned is, when you're writing a novel, at least when I'm writing a novel, what I'm looking for is a container, this vessel I can launch. And that vessel will be a story that will move like a story, because I think narrative is really important. I think there's tremendous discipline and skill in telling a story really well, and I love the challenge of it. But at the same time, I want a story to carry my obsessions, to be able to explore multiple dimensions under the line what it is I'm interested in. And so this book had it for me, and I knew it. I knew it early on. It was like, okay, this thing has energy. It had capaciousness. I could feel it.
Well, and also you say that narrative is very important. One of the great... Everybody knows what the book's about, right? Does Paul need to tell you in a minute what it's about? No. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah? Tell them what it's about for 1 minute.
60 seconds. You got a timer?
Done it.
Okay. The book is set in a present-day counterfactual or near-future Ireland. It doesn't say. And it tells the story of Eilish Stack, who is a scientist, works for a pharmaceutical company. She's married to Larry, who is a trade unionist for the Teachers Union of Ireland. And they've got 4 kids, 3 of whom are teenagers. And it's the Ireland that I would know and recognize, except there's something just slightly off. And that's revealed in the opening when 2 officers from the Garda National Services Bureau knock on the door. And Ireland, up until this point, has never had secret police. And now there's the secret police. And they want to speak to Larry. And so what's happening in the background is there has been a populist government has been elected. And they've brought through emergency powers. And now that's the thread of the unraveling. And the democratic norms are beginning to slide. The media is beginning to be curbed. And so life in a liberal democracy, which we all take for granted, is beginning to come undone. And that's it in a nutshell. A slightly long nutshell, but...
No, that's good. So... You're talking about narrative. One of the very strong suits of the book is the gradual way that this is both revealed and plays out in a quite inexorable way. Mm-hmm. You know, it starts with a knock on the door, which is a Kafkaesque, the trial kind of a knock on the door, isn't it? It's the knock that takes you out of the normal life and into the surrealness. And then... one thing I wanted to ask you about, I was going to say, the question was going to be, the novel's not really dystopian, is it?
Not at
all. But then I actually read this essay and you actually say, I found myself writing a dystopian novel. Yeah. So I have to slightly...
Here's my inconsistency.
But do you know what I mean? Yeah. To me, it's a catchphrase. Yeah. It's a catch-all phrase, dystopian. But it's not dystopian, is it? Because the point is... you're writing about Ireland, but this is happening in places.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, it could happen in America after the next election. Yeah. It could happen anywhere and right now. So I didn't think of it as dystopian. Just talk about that.
I mean, these labels are very reductive. And I became aware that in the way that I was writing the early parts of the novel, that it would be read as dystopian. That was just inevitable. That my editor, that was exactly, you know, what she came back. And I knew that that was an inescapable label that it was going to be put on the novel. But I knew that I was doing something much more interesting, which was I was going to explode the form. And one way for me that I wanted to explode the form was to inject as much realism into the novel as possible. Because in my mind, when I think of dystopian fiction, there's sort of a paper mache quality to it. You know, I'm really interested in the real, and I think that the job of serious fiction is to sort of grab a hold of reality, is to somehow seize a hold of reality and get it down onto the page. And so this book really takes you down to the heartbeat of the moment with Ailish Stack. Just that sense of being in the present time with her, the present unfolding moment. And this is something that all my books have been doing. Mm. And I suppose it's something that I borrow from... I'm a long-time meditator, and it's something that I've tried to work into my sentences. But just that feeling of just the now. And that's what gives the book its immediacy, but that's also what helps to explode the form, because at some point, if there's a reader who's not hearing me having this conversation and they just go, oh, dystopian novel, at some point they realize what's actually happening in this book.
Right.
And that's when the idea of it being dystopian becomes an impossibility. And also, I mean, the book is having so much conversation with the past and the future and the present, which a dystopian, I don't think truly... perhaps no. allows for, you know, and...
I agree.
And that there's... that, to me, this book, what I wanted to do is to create a mythic space inside it. That's why it doesn't say when it's set. You're allowing space for the mythic to enter, and so the feeling of the past is... there's always these moments of resonance where she's sensing something that's happening to her, but that's also happened through the ages.
Fascinating. And also that, like, your idea about living in the now also reminds me of a concept in the book, which is the end of the world is a local event. Mm. It's the same idea, isn't it?
Yeah.
In a geographical way. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I get asked all the time, oh, do you call the book Prophet Song because you're trying to make a prophecy for what's going to come to Ireland? And it's like, no, really? No, I don't think so. But... you can take that if you like, you know. I do think that there's a, you know, it's possible that a liberal democracy could go this way, and it doesn't take an awful lot to join the dots from the present moment to the opening of this book. For me, that the meaning of the title comes back to a moment when Ailish... and I actually say, like, this book is an unraveling. It's a massive unraveling of the known world and into the abyss. And Ailish has gone through this unraveling. She's gone into the eighth and ninth circle of hell. And she understands that this idea that she's had all her life, that the end of the world comes... this biblical apocalypse, that it's complete nonsense, that the end of the world is occurring again and again and again. It's just occurring. It just comes to your city. It comes to your town. It knocks on your door. But for everybody else in the world, it's an event on the news. It passes into myth. It passes into folklore.
Well, I mean, when I say the book's inexorable, it is. I mean, there's no way that once you've kind of begun on the story of this book, it doesn't have a surprise ending. Do you think...
I do think the ending is a bit of a surprise, sorry.
Okay, go on, tell us about that.
Yeah.
Without giving the ending away, tell us about that.
I mean, what I'll say is the ending is... it's a question. The ending is a question.
Right.
It's framed as a question. And I think questions are more important for fiction than answers. And the ending is a question.
What was I going to say?
I interrupted you.
No, that's really totally fine.
Very impulsive of me.
Your right to do that. Well, maybe while I'm thinking of what I was going to say, you could read the beginning of your book,
okay,
because I think it'd be a lovely time to do that.
Okay. I shall read from the opening. The night has come, and she has not heard the knocking, standing at the window looking out onto the garden. How the dark gathers without sound the cherry trees. It gathers the last of the leaves, and the leaves do not resist the dark but accept the dark in whisper. Tired now, the day almost behind her, all that still has to be done before bed, and the children settled in the living room, this feeling of rest for a moment by the glass. Watching the darkening garden and the wish to be at one with this darkness, to step outside and lie down with it, to lie with the fallen leaves and let the night pass over, to wake then with the dawn and rise renewed with the morning come. But the knocking. She hears it pass into thought, the sharp, insistent rapping each knock possessed so fully of the knocker she begins to frown. Then Bailey, too, is knocking on the glass door to the kitchen. He calls out to her, "Ma'am," pointing to the hallway without lifting his eyes from the screen. Eilish finds her body moving towards the hall with the baby in her arms. She opens the front door and two men are standing before the porch glass, almost faceless in the dark. She turns on the porch light and the men are known in an instant from how they are stood. The night cold air suspiring, it seems, as she slides open the patio door. The suburban quiet, the rain falling almost unspoken onto St. Lawrence Street upon the black car parked in front of the house. How the men seem to carry the feeling of the night. She watches them from within her own protective feeling. The young man on the left is asking if her husband is home, and there is something in the way he looks at her. The remote yet scrutinizing eyes that make it seem as though he is trying to seize hold of something within her. In a blink, she has sought up and down the street, seeing a lone walker with a dog under an umbrella, the willows nodding to the rain, the strobings of a large TV screen in the Zajic's house across the street. She checks herself then, almost laughing, this universal reflex of guilt when the police call to your door. Ben begins to squirm in her arms, and the older plainclothes man to her right is watching the child. His face seems to soften, and so she addresses herself to him. She knows he too is a father. Such things are always known. That other fellow is much too young, too neat and hard-boned. She begins to speak, aware of a sudden falter in her voice. "He'll be home soon, in an hour or so. Would you like me to give him a ring?" "No, that will not be necessary, Mrs. Stack. When he comes home, could you tell him to call us at his earliest convenience? This is my card." "Please call me Eilish. Is it something I can help you with?" "No, I'm afraid not, Mrs. Stack. This is a matter for your husband." The older plainclothes man is smiling fully at the child, and she watches for a moment the wrinkles about the mouth. It is a face put out by solemnity, the wrong face for the job. "It is nothing to worry about, Mrs. Stack." "Why should I be worried, Garda?" "Yes, indeed, Mrs. Stack. We don't want to be taking up any more of your time, and aren't we damp enough this evening making calls? It'll be hard work getting ourselves dry by the heater in the car." She slides the patio door closed, holding the card in her hand, watching the two men return to the car, watching the car move up the street. It breaks for the junction, and its taillights intensify, taking the look of two eyes agleam. She looks once more onto the street, returned to an evening's quiet, the heat from the hall as she steps inside and shuts the front door, and then she stands a moment examining the card and finds she has been holding her breath. This feeling now that something has come into the house. She wants to put the baby down. She wants to stand and think, seeing how it stood with the two men and came into the hallway of its own accord. Something formless yet felt. She can sense it skulking alongside her. She steps through the living room past the children. Molly is holding the remote control over Bailey's head, his hands flapping in the air. He turns towards her with a pleading look. "Ma'am, tell her to put my show back on." Eilish closes the kitchen door and places the child in the rocker, begins to clear from the table her laptop and diary, but stops and closes her eyes. This feeling that came into the house has followed. She looks to her phone and picks it up, her hand hesitating. She sends Larry a message, finds herself again by the window watching outside. The darkening garden not to be wished upon now, for something of that darkness has come into the house.
It's so interesting, isn't it, when you hear someone reading aloud a book they've read, because if somebody... Well, firstly, I would like to say that what I forgot I was going to say was one of the movements of the book, it seems to me you talk about, you know, the end of the world or war being something that's happening elsewhere, is that, you know, slowly but surely, she becomes someone you'd see on television, doesn't she? I mean, that's the movement of the book. She becomes... But what I wanted to say about that, what you might not know if you haven't read the book from what you've just heard, is there are no quotation marks. There's sections in the book. There's chapters, which are numbered, but there's no paragraphs within those chapters, and there's no speech marks either. And I was thinking about that, as you know, because that is a stylistic decision, right?
It's hardly unusual, though.
Not unusual, but it is nonetheless a stylistic decision.
Yeah.
And to me, that was, it felt like in a society where people become a little bit paranoid about what the authorities might have on them and the forbidden thoughts that they're having, that it seemed to make you, the reader, worried about if that was something someone was saying and who was quite saying it and whose mind it was in, or was she saying it out loud, or was she saying it privately to herself? And I wondered if any of those were, you know, I wondered what, you know, just what do you think about any of that?
When you sit down to write a novel and you're finding you're shaping those early pages, you're looking for a number of different things. One is you're looking for a song, a sound, a rhythm, and you get a sense of the rhythm there from the reading. But you're also building a mesh, which is the form of the novel. All the little decisions you make, whether the book's going to be written, the sound and the feeling and the syntax, the grammar, all of these things are decisions that should point towards the meaning of the novel. That should everything you do should associate around a meaning. And so early on, the book just... I was writing with paragraphs, and the book just said, no. And so I took them out, and suddenly it felt right. I never use quotation marks. Frankly, I think they're ugly. I think that when we speak... We don't go around, I'm using quotation marks now. I think that if you're trying to get close to the feeling of the real, I think that if you're trying to, you know, this book is about deconditioning, perhaps, the reader, so a little bit of deconditioning in the form is useful. But all of these things, like the long sentences, there's a lot of long sentences in this book. And again, they do a number of things. One is they take the reader into these moments of being, of just Eilish being alive, just Eilish encountering the moment as it's flowing around her. But at the same time, the long sentence captures that feeling of just inevitability, that Eilish is imprisoned in the text, and it's like there's a riptide. It's like she's been taken off her feet. And she's just been pulled, and she's swimming, and she's grasping around, and she's trying to figure out how is she going to get out of this situation. Because I'm not giving away a whole lot here, but I should have said earlier, her husband Larry is taken in for questioning, and later on he has disappeared, and so that's the start of you know, her dilemmas, and she's caught in this text. And it's just this unbelievable pull throughout the book. And one of the things that allowed me to create that feeling of inevitability in the text was I understood early on what the last line of the book would be. And that last line I saw as a proof, as a QED, as something that I had to prove true. And for that to be true, for the reader, for that line to have its impact on the reader, for that line to be true for Eilish, for her to say that, everything before that had to be true, like a series of equations. Mm. And so I was shaping the book like equations, just like this because of this because of this because of this because of this. And any time I tried to deviate out of that, the book would say no. It would just literally say, you can't do that. That's not truthful. And so there is this sense of, within the unraveling, what I hope is a very deep sense of truth, of inevitability, of this is the logic of events, you know? But what I'm mapping in this book is the personal cost of these events.
And that really, I find very illuminating, the equation idea, because the book feels like it's solving itself in a quite deliberate way. That was what I meant about it being inexorable, because it feels like it's almost like you know what's going to happen next because you have seen some of these things. You've read about them. You fear them. Yeah. You know, the bit when she's running around between hospitals, her son has a accident. What happened? I can't remember. I'm suddenly... What happened?
We'd be giving away...
I suppose we would. I was trying to think of a nice... She leaves him in one hospital.
Yeah.
And then there's an incredibly surreal passage where she goes to another hospital.
Make him stop.
Happily. I was just using that as an example of something where you're like, oh, can this get worse here?
Yeah. I mean, I'm interested in the labyrinth. I'm interested in what Eilish cannot know. And it goes back to the Greeks, Greek tragedy, this sense of characters making these choices with great certainty, but without any true knowledge. And the fates have you know, the fates are operating blindly behind them. And I'm deeply interested in this as a writer and trying to articulate in a modern way these old ideas, because we go through life, you know, we're fundamentally blind. We truly have no knowledge. And we convince ourselves that we know what we're about, and that we convince ourselves that we know what we're doing all the time. And Eilish is constantly making these decisions where she's trying to outmaneuver this thing that she's ranged against. But she's in the labyrinth, and so she's constantly reaping this crop of the unforeseen. The unforeseen is what we get all the time. That life is completely and utterly unpredictable. And I'm interested in trying to map that. Eilish caught up in the white hot moment of her life, and this sort of inalienable, inscrutable thing that's just too vast, that's beyond comprehension, and it's unfolding. And we always meet these things in our lives. We are all caught up in mechanisms of whether it's politics or history or COVID or whatever it is. These things that throw us around like specks of dust. And you know, it goes back to free will. And I'm interested in these little things, you know, and trying to map them. And so when I think of Prophet Song, I think of the book more like that rather than a political book, that it's actually demonstrating these particular problems.
I read somewhere that initially there was some thoughts about Syria involved, that you'd seen the crisis that was unwinding in Syria. You'd thought, the West isn't really paying attention to that. I would like to deal with that, and that at some point a breakthrough moment for you was like, well, I'll write about Syria, say, and that crisis, but I'll set it in Ireland because I know Ireland.
Yeah.
So my, is that a fair surmise of what that, I read?
That's, yeah, I mean, that's one origin story of
right.
many, you know, and it, the problem of that is that what goes into the making of a novel is actually many things
sure.
that jumble around in the subconscious. And my editor in London, Juliet Mabey, said, for goodness sake, you've given out at least three origin stories to this novel. And I said, but they're all true.
Right.
You know, they are all true. And, you know, I had written for a friend a screenplay. It didn't get made, but it involved a Syrian character. And I had done a lot of reading on Syria. And so it was in my head. And, you know, as a citizen, I was also just amazed and concerned about what I'd watched unfold because, you know, Syria was the collapse of a complete collapse of a modern state. And 2 million people, I think, came into Europe. And it was the largest refugee crisis since World War II. And the situation was kind of met with largely with indifference. And so as a citizen, I was just sort of baffled by that. I couldn't understand just this sort of the hate that was being directed towards Syrian refugees and the fact that people would get on those boats. And that is something that I put to myself when I was writing this book as well, is that what does it take for somebody to get on one of those boats? What does it take if you're an educated, middle class, for example, person with kids? What makes you get on one of those boats? It seems inconceivable. And it goes back to, you mentioned the article, it goes back to the problem of the spectacle, that we watch the news and we've been getting the news as spectacle all our lives. I mean, I'm 46, so I'm getting it all my life. Grew up watching the, you know, eating my dinner and the news is on in the background. And you're seeing things that to somebody from 100 years ago would have been inconceivable to them. And we are completely inured against it. We are, our self-defenses are up. We don't process what we see. And there's good reason for that, because we wouldn't be able to get out of bed in the morning if we were to truly carry within us, you know, the truth. But I'm interested in what fiction can do and how fiction can uniquely occupy a place where it can take the reader into the feeling of events, not the description of the politics, the description of the action, but actually what it's like to live in that moment. And when you do that, you bypass the self-defenses that we've all got up, that you're able to get around that, and you're able to make the reader feel something that maybe they've not been able to feel before. And this is something that people are telling me all the time. It's like, I feel something from this book that I've not felt before. And that's to me is very satisfying, because, you know, I remember reading The Mayor of Casterbridge at 16 and sitting on my bed and just bawling, crying, feeling this just amazement and sorrow from a novel. And as we get older, fiction seems to impact us a little bit less and we become, you know, it's like the spectacle. And so I believe in fiction. I believe that fiction can work its magic on us, and that it has, and when you create these simulations, you are creating empathy and not sympathy, but empathy, because you feel it for yourself. And I'm really interested in that. I want to make the reader feel again, rather than just, you know, flicking through the pages.
We're going to open it up for questions. Shall we do that? No, we're ready to do that. Let's do it. So it'd be great if those questions were questions.
No statements, right?
It's just an idea. Who's got a question for Mr. Paul Lynch?
This is, I did read the book and really, I don't want to say loved it, but it was beautiful and very poetic to me. I did hear an interview you did with Scott Simon, and it seemed to me that the Booker Prize has really impacted you, and I don't know when that interview was done, And I'm just curious, are you becoming more comfortable with that?
That was about 60 interviews ago.
That's what you said on... Yes.
Am I becoming more comfortable with it? You know, I was sitting in a car in Jaipur, a little small car with Hernan Diaz, and we were doing about 3 hours of sightseeing, and he's just won the Pulitzer, and I've just won the Booker. And we're in the car, and we're just laughing at our lives and talking about how are we to get through it? How do you get through such a thing? Because it can be fatal to the writing life. And we were laughing about not taking ourselves too seriously for a start, not taking the prizes too seriously. But the truth of the matter is the world treats you very differently after it. And so you don't have a choice but to meet it. And in some ways, I'm continually amazed by what's happened, because, you know, there's 90% of writers will tell you they want to win the Booker Prize, and the other 10% are lying. That's the truth of it. But you don't think it's going to happen, because it's too damn hard. We were saying earlier, there's too many things have to align, you know, for a big prize to come your way. But ultimately, though, what I worry about is just not getting to the writing desk. That's because, you know, the reason I'm a writer and the reason I love being a writer, even though the work is difficult and it's painful, is that when you write, you access your best self. You disappear into the act of writing, and time falls away, and you go into flow, as it's called. But you're also accessing a higher aspect of mind. That's, you know, it's an aspect of mind that artists have been chasing, that meditators talk about as, you know, as the Buddha mind, or Christian mystics, monastics talk about it. All these different traditions all talk about this particular aspect of mind. And when you come alongside that or tune into it on a regular basis, it's a kind of joy, really, because you are your best self. And when you are not writing, it's harder. You miss it. You know, you're not giving expression to something that's really unique and authentic within you. Because you are living at your most authentic self, I think, when you do that. And so my vow to myself is that I have... My calendar is crazy. It's just really crazy. And my agent has a joke now that he's running a travel agency as well as a literary agency. But I've made a vow that I'm just going to try and write in these little pockets of days when I'm in Dublin, and just, you know, when I'm not jet lagged, I will try and write something, and that's how I get through it. And the good news is next November there'll be somebody else.
So I read the book, and I have a question. It was interesting. You said that Eilish, there's things that she just couldn't possibly know, and that we as readers may know either from history or just reading in between the lines what's going to happen. Did you find yourself, while you're writing, getting annoyed at her? Because even though she didn't know all the secrecy that was going on, there were little glimpses handed to her that she rejected.
That's a good question. Denial.
Like, did
is
you just want to shake her?
Yeah, but denial is what is one of the key things this book is exploring, the problem of denial. All of us have looked at news footage from history, and we looked at, you know, we look at the Holocaust and we say, oh, I would have got out. I would have known. That would have been me. I'd be long gone. And this book asks the question, well, really? Would you? Would you really have gone? Because let's look at the complexity of what's involved. Let's look at the complexity of what it's like to be Eilish Stack in your 40s, in that, just that great squeeze of midlife, early midlife. You've got an ailing father, you've got children at school with all three different teenagers with three different sets of problems, you've got an infant child, you've got a career, you've got a husband that's suddenly been swallowed by the state. how are you meant to go on? Well, denying the truth of the reality is a huge part of that, because you have to keep the show on the road. And there's her father has a moment where he says to her, he's this moment of lucidity, because he's sliding into dementia, but he understands what's going on. He's not in denial. And he says to her, Eilish, you need to leave. And her sister in Canada, Anya, is on the phone saying, like, can you not see what's going on? Like, you have to get out. And she tells her, history is a silent record of those who did not know when to leave. And Eilish's response is, well, that's all very well for you to say, but I'm dealing with all of this stuff. You can't just go. And what if Dad falls and breaks a hip? What then? And so all of this complexity is what locks her into place and what fuels the denial. And it's also seeking to answer some questions that I was interested in, which is, what does it take to make somebody, as I said, get on one of those boats? And what I learned writing this book is that we carry within ourselves multiple identities that make us who we are. You know, we are a spouse, or we are a parent, or we are children, and we are something in our career, and we live in a place. And all of these things combine in different ways to make us who we are. And for you to take one of those boats, I realized that all of those things just have to be unplugged, one after the other, until there's nothing left. And that's when you'll go.
And even when you do go, there turn out to be practical reasons why you can't go, because there's passports and there's bureaucracy, and which was one of her big problems, even when she's thinking about it.
You know, I had a conversation with an Uber driver last night, and I asked him if he was happy being an Uber driver, and he was like smiling, and he had the car a year, I think, and he told me he spent the previous year riding a bike in the cold in Boston, and that was a disaster, and he seemed really happy, and I asked him another question, and then the sorrow came out, and it was incredible that it turns out that he was from Afghanistan, but he had to leave because of the Taliban, because he'd been working for the US government. And when he started to talk about what he'd lost, it was incredible. Like the complete change of atmosphere, like the sorrow just came out of him. And his story ended up, it was incredible. I couldn't believe it. He was told that he would get a visa to the States, and after 6 months, his wife and his two children, who were 4 and 6, I think, would be allowed to come to America. And then he came here and he gets his visa, but he can't leave the country, as I understood it. But then he was told that it would take 6 years for them to come here. And so he's been here for 2 years, and he hasn't seen his family for 4 years. And that's the sorrow that I'm interested in. Mm. But it was incredible, just a couple of questions just unlocked all that from him. And it was so, it was just, I couldn't believe it, to be honest with you. Do you know? It was something else.
I actually have two questions if we have time, but the first one is...
we'll be the judge of
the
that.
The first one is the most important one. How did you and Hernan Diaz wind up in the same car together?
We were at the Jaipur Literary Festival, and... I was going sightseeing, and I had like 3 hours in the afternoon. And then I just texted him, and I said, Hernan, I'm going sightseeing right now. And he said, wait. And then he appeared flailing, coming. And we went, and we ended up being trapped in the traffic for hours. And we were 2 hours late for an event after. He's a genuinely lovely man.
Well, thank you for that.
And the second question.
Well, the second goes back to what you were talking about about Syria and how the research that you had done when you were writing the screenplay. the book itself, I mean, it really draws you into kind of that day-to-day and what people are really going through when you have, and I'm going to use the word dystopia. Where did that come from? How were you able to, like, place us there? And we're every day she is going through this, and you're feeling it. It goes back to what you were saying about feeling. But where did that come from?
Oh, God. Where did it come from? I mean, like, there's so much that goes into the writing of a novel, and a certain amount of it is rational, and you have ideas about what it is you want to achieve. And I knew what I was setting out to do. And then there are other aspects, that's what I refer to as the magic. That's the intuitive aspect. But because what happens betwixt the pen and the page is a mystery, you know? And but for you to have the feeling of what you get from this book, that's something that I knew how to create. And so I was making decisions to create that feeling in the reader. And but to articulate it now after the fact is, that's like some sort of technical essay. So I'm sorry to disappoint you.
I had a question actually about the relationship between film and your writing. And if when you are writing, is there sort of a certain cinematography that you are moving through as you're writing, or if there's any sort of films that actually inspire some of your writing that you return to as you're weaving through narrative?
I was a film critic. I love cinema very deeply. I don't watch as much as I used to, as seriously as I used to, because life's getting in the way. But it's a big part of my imagination. And, you know, I don't just operate by drawing influences from fiction. You know, I draw very deeply from poetry. I draw from visual art. I draw from film. And I learned very early on when I started writing that my imagination is very visual. I see in images. And I want you to see those images too. I'm not interested in fiction. It's just telling you, you know, John walked into a room. I want you to see that and feel it and have it articulated to you in such a way that it becomes sensual, that there's details in it that really evoke something for you. And I think in images, and I try to write in images. And often those images, sometimes the really good ones, come from the subconscious. And that's what you're doing, is you're chasing these images, and they're often compressed symbolically. You don't know what they are. And so you write towards it, and you're trying to unpack it. And when you unpack it, meaning emerges. And sometimes whole books emerge from a single image.
If you could think of a movie that you would most analogize this book with, what movie would come to mind for you? If you... it's a bit of a parlor game, yeah, but I mean it seriously.
I was actually asked by MUBI to choose a film from their database for they were doing this thing with the partnership with the Booker Prize, and I said immediately, Christian Petzold film. This is the jet lag now, right? It's a Christian Petzold film, and it's set in the south of France, and it's doing something. I watched it, and I thought, my God, he's doing something really similar to Prophet Song.
Huh.
And I thought, this is interesting, because what he was doing was, it felt like a World War II narrative, like a classic, got to get our visa, got to get on the boat, you know, basically Casablanca kind of story, but told within the immediacy of the now, of the present. So it didn't feel like now, it felt futuristic, but it also felt the mythic past was operating within the present moment in the film. And Transit, the film is called Transit.
Right, I've never seen that.
And it's a really good film. And I thought, he's thinking along the same lines as I'm thinking.
That's
and
so interesting.
We're both tuning in to something out there. And you know.
Maybe, how does the word allegorical strike you for Prophet Song?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that the closer you can get to myth in your writing, the more universal weight the story can contain. And there's a line that I really wanted to use from Cormac McCarthy's The Crossing as an epigraph to the book, and we couldn't get it because, unfortunately, very sadly, he was dying, and just before press, and so we had to go. We couldn't get permission, but I was really sad we couldn't use it because it gets to that idea of allegory or myth, and it was the line goes something like this, that the task of the narrator appears to be an easy one. He appears to be required to choose his tale from among the many that are possible, but that, of course, is not the case. The task is rather to make many of the one. And so instead of writing fiction that's trying to tell all the voices, and it's actually you write one thing that can contain all the voices. And that's what I was doing. That's what I knew I was doing. It's what I wanted to do. And I realized that maybe I had achieved it to some degree, because when I was in London, I met somebody from Palestine, and she just said, like, you've told her a story. And the night before that, I'd met someone from Ukraine, and she said the exact same thing. So she was just full of passion, saying, this book is our story. And, you know, and I was in India last week, and the book is resonating very deeply there for the same reasons. And I'm just a guy in Dublin, do you know? I'm a writer in a room in Dublin, but somehow there's some universal aspect that this book holds. And it's kind of a magic if it's doing that. And I can only go by what people are telling me, that I think there's a kind of magic to that too.
There certainly is, and it's a wonderful book. Ladies and gentlemen, will you please give a warm round of applause to Paul Lynch?
Thank you. Thank you. All right.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.